Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome to another episode of Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike's Medical Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Mike Todorovich. I am joined by my co-host, Dr. Matt Barton.
Good morning.
It's still morning. Just to refresh everybody who we are and what we do, we're senior lecturers of anatomy and physiology and pathophysiology.
Because we're old and decrepit.
And pharmacology. We have PhDs in neuroscience.
Not at all related to blood pressure medications.
No, which is the topic of today. But we do.
Did I spoil that?
We do teach many health students, though, was the point I'm trying to get across.
Glad.
This is the content that you, all these episodes that you listen to, these are the topics that we lecture to at university to health students, right? Nurses, medicos, allied health professionals, and so forth. We teach these aspiring health professionals about these topics, including today's topic, which you so rudely interrupted about, which is what? Sorry, I forgot what it was.
Anti-hypertensive medications.
Blood pressure meds. And so I think the best way in to begin, and I think this is how I start every episode, is I say the best way to begin, I think, is to talk about the blood pressure equation.
You do that with every lecture.
Well, no. Well, if you've listened to the blood pressure podcast and the hypertension podcast, and now you're on the antihypertensives, you're probably aware of this blood pressure equation because we don't shut up about it.
Yeah.
But for those of you who haven't listened to the other episodes, blood pressure is a really simple equation. Firstly, to define blood pressure, it is the force that the blood places on the walls of our blood vessels. That's all it is, blood pressure. And we often measure it as the pressure that it places on the walls of our arterial system.
Yep.
That's how we generally measure it. But there's two values that we measure. There's the top value called the systolic, which is generally about 120 millimeters of mercury, and the bottom value, which we call the diastolic, which is about 80 millimeters of mercury. Both those values are indications of the pressure of this blood moving through the vessels. One, the top value, when the heart contracts. So that's the highest pressure because it's pushing that blood through.
Systole.
And then the bottom value is the pressure that continues to propagate through our bloodstream when the heart relaxes. Because the blood vessels are stretchy, under systole, they've stretched out, and then when the heart relaxes, they snap back and continue to propagate blood. That's the diastolic value, the bottom value. All right. So we've got that down pat. That's blood pressure. Now, to figure out this pressure or this force, we need to understand two important concepts, one of which is cardiac output and the other one is vascular resistance. Mm. Sometimes termed systemic vascular resistance.
Or total
vascular resistance or peripheral vascular resistance, but we're just going to say vascular resistance. So blood pressure, in actual fact, is equal to cardiac output times vascular resistance. Now, that's it. That's the equation. Done. Easy. But we need to define what-
Too easy.
It is too easy, but we need to define what each are. So firstly, cardiac output. What is that? Very simply put.
The amount of blood that comes out of your heart, which is the pump per minute.
Easy.
Yep.
Look at that. And that can be altered by the heart rate.
The speed of the heart.
And the volume that it ejects with every contraction.
Yep.
Right? So there's that.
Yep.
Done.
That's pretty easy.
The vascular resistance can be a couple of things, but it's the resistance that the blood encounters as it moves through the vessels. So think about what type of things can increase the resistance or decrease the resistance in our bloodstream. Well, what do you think, Matt?
The diameter of the pipes.
Okay, so if that's narrowed, is it more resistant?
More resistant.
Okay. And so if it's dilated or relaxed, it's less resistance.
Yep.
Okay. So that's one thing that can alter resistance. What else?
The thickness of the blood.
That's right. So that predominantly has to do with the number of blood cells inside of the blood or a reduced volume of water.
Yeah, like if you're dehydrated.
Severely.
Yeah.
Right? And they're the two major things. Now, you can obviously have the length of the blood vessel, but that's not something that we can really change overnight. However, people with a larger body mass have more blood vessels and therefore the resistance is higher because there's more vessels to move through.
Yep.
So that's just one important point. So at the end of the day, the reason why we're telling you this is because when blood pressure is elevated, and to understand that, I recommend you listen to our hypertension episode. It's because something has elevated the cardiac output. It might be heart rate has increased. It might be the contractile force has increased. It might be the volume of blood has increased. Or something has increased the resistance in the blood vessel. So the blood vessel's narrowed or the thickness of the blood has increased. They're the major points. And the reason why we're saying it is because today we're talking about management of hypertension.
Medications.
And the medications we can use to lower it. And they all work by addressing one or more of each of those factors.
Yeah.
Right? Simple.
Yep.
Now, the great thing is there's an easy way for us to remember these antihypertensive medications.
And I'm wondering, I didn't know this when I studied this.
Yeah.
Did you know this?
What?
This method.
Yeah. I did a video on it like a month
ago. No, but when you studied it.
The first time I studied it? Oh, no, I didn't.
Yeah,
so I thought you meant like when
no,
you-
No, no, no. Sorry, when you were a student, undergraduate student.
No, I did not know about the A, B, C, D, E of blood pressure.
Yeah.
Now, I did a video on the A, B, C, D of hypertensive drugs, but you've added an E to this one.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that.
It's not a mainstream one, but I'll just put it in there.
So I'm looking at a piece of paper in front of Matt at the moment, and it's not just A, B, C, D, E. It's A, B, C, D, E. So you got a couple of A's here.
Four A's.
Four A's.
Yeah.
So should we start at the A?
Yep, we can do that. It makes the most sense.
It really does, doesn't it, Matt?
But I think we should point out here, the way we've categorized this is not based on clinical preference.
Good point.
It's just by mechanism. And so it's just an easier way to remember the categories by their mechanism.
Yeah, we'll go through the
drugs. Opposed to what we recommend would be the first line, second line, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. It's just us outlining the different options that are available for these medications.
And we will address preference in regards to what's general. So it's all about the generalities, right? Every individual is different and the antihypertensive drug that they are prescribed will be relevant to them. So we can't say what the best antihypertensive drug is, but we can talk about what is generally considered a first line antihypertensive or not. So just keep that in mind. But like Matt said, we're going to go through the A, B, C, D. It's not in any particular order, but A, what's the first A that you'd like to address?
Let's address alpha ones.
Alpha ones. So what is alpha one referring to?
Well, this is an adrenergic receptor.
Adrenergic, did you say?
Yeah.
Okay.
We've done a podcast on this, right?
Have we?
Yeah, we've done adrenergic receptors.
All right. If we haven't, we should.
Definitely have. Definitely have. So alpha one generally located, not exclusively, but generally located on blood vessels.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yes.
So if you throw noradrenaline onto the alpha one receptor, it will cause the blood vessels, specifically the arteries, to clamp, not close, but become smaller in their diameter.
Yes. Okay. I like to, and it may or may not be the best place to bring this up, but I like to tell students that when you've got the adrenergic system, right? So adrenaline being released either by neurons or through the adrenal gland or whatever it may be, that there's a whole bunch of receptors that adrenaline can bind to. There's alpha receptors and beta receptors. And you've got alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2, beta 3. Mm. And I tell students, forget beta 3. It's located on fat cells, clinically not super relevant. So you've got alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2. And what you can do is you can align them up and say alpha 1 and beta 1, so the ones, when you throw adrenaline at them, they stimulate the tissues that they're located on to do their function, to do their job, right? If you throw adrenaline at the twos, alpha two and beta two, it triggers those tissues to stop doing their function. And both, because it's all associated with the adrenergic system, it's all associated with a fight or flight response. Yeah, yeah. So your body's going to do things to keep you alive in times of stress. And students say to me, what do you mean? I throw adrenaline at alpha two or beta two and it stops that tissue from doing its job. Why would I want to stop a tissue from doing its job if I'm trying to fight or run away? And I go, well, think about tissues that you need to tell to relax so that you can fight or run away, one of which is your airways. You don't want to stimulate the muscles in your airways to work because that results in constriction, less oxygen getting in. So you want to tell them to relax. You want to inhibit them so the muscles dilate. Therefore, respiratory airways, musculature, has either alpha 2 or beta 2 receptors. Mm. You can now deduce that, right? And the same thing goes for alpha 1, beta 1, is that the heart, for example, if I want to stimulate the heart, it's either going to be, you're going to stimulate it to contract. It's either going to be alpha 1 or beta 1. So at least you can deduce from that.
Yep.
I just want to use that as an aside. Now you said alpha 1, so that's stimulate, and you said it's stimulating smooth muscle, in this case, on blood vessels.
Yes.
And so it tells them to constrict, narrow the diameter, increasing vascular resistance, increasing blood pressure.
Yeah.
So if we have an alpha one-
Well, the resistance would be in certain blood vessels, not all of them.
Sure.
But you know, the blood vessels that you don't want to take blood to in this particular time.
Yeah.
So this would be potentially blood vessels to the gut.
All right.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So-
So these are antagonistic drugs.
Yeah, so these drugs block alpha 1 receptors.
Right.
So therefore they're going to have a dilating effect on the blood vessels that have an alpha 1 receptor.
Decreasing resistance, decreasing blood pressure.
Yep.
Beautiful.
And so these drugs end with the suffix osin.
Osin, spell it?
O-S-I-N-S.
O-S-I-N-S, so they're the osins.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, okay.
So prazosin.
Oh,
okay.
Can I say it again?
Prazosin.
Matt's forte is drug pronunciation.
Yeah. So there's, so the osins are essentially the alpha 1 blockers.
Yep.
Okay. They're not that common in terms of their use for hypertension.
Right.
They could have other uses. So there's some that are used more commonly in benign prosthetic hyperplasia.
Oh,
and so this would
be- So not prostate cancer, but prostate hyperplasia.
Yeah, so these-
Which I think nearly every single-
Male over the age of 50 would start to develop.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So basically what this drug would do is, normally the alpha 1 would tell the sphincter to the at the bottom part of the bladder-
Sounds like the beginning of a joke.
To close.
What does the alpha 1 say to the sphincter?
Close, please. So if you antagonize this, you open them up.
Right.
And so one of the side effects for a person with benign prosthetic hyperplasia is they'd have urinary retention.
Mm.
And so if you can relax that by using this drug, it can help relieve them of urinary retention.
Interesting. Uh-huh. So they're the alpha 1 antagonists.
Yeah. So that's generally how they would work. It's not too technical.
No.
Side effects would be postural hypotension.
So when you stand up, blood pressure goes down. That would be for all of them, I assume though, right? Postural hypertension. If you're using an antihypertensive drug.
I think some worse than
you're
others.
You've got to be careful with the dosage and your positioning and things like that.
And because we've just spoke about them relaxing the sphincter, you can develop something called stress incontinence, which is you kind of get leakage when you increase intra-abdominal pressure, like coughing, laughing,
bladder
sneezing.
Leakage.
Yep. Because you just lost that sphincter control.
Gotcha, because it's dilated.
And it's also potentially leading to impotence, which I think is more to do with...
Sympathetic.
Yeah, like a sympathetic.
Yeah.
Because of the effect that it has on the seminal tract, but possibly also the blood flow to maybe to the penis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because generally parasympathetic is erection.
Yeah, it's good.
So the ejaculation is
finishing.
Sympathetic, finishing. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good place to finish for that. So,
so it's alpha one.
That's alpha one. So what's another A that we can look at?
So then we can move into the kidney ones. So these are the essentially working in the RAS system.
The RAS, Matthew?
Yeah.
The RAS? The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system?
Do we? Well, I guess we have to go through this very briefly.
Let's, I guess we do. All right. So can I do it? Because I do it all the time.
It's your favorite. One of your top five favorite systems, isn't it?
All right. Let's see how quickly I can do it, right? So we know that your kidneys need to get 20% of that cardiac output every minute. So that's 1 liter of blood every minute needs to go to the kidneys. Of that 1 liter, it needs to filter 120 milliliters every minute. So that's what the kidneys must do in order to maintain that your blood has the right things in it and all the wrong things are taken out of it. So filtration. If that blood pressure or the blood volume drops going to the kidneys are sensitive to that because it means it won't filter properly. So the kidneys have a response mechanism and that response mechanism is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Firstly, if the blood pressure is low and the blood volume's low, it triggers the release of a hormone called renin. That's the first thing. So now we've got renin floating through the bloodstream. The liver will produce and release something called angiotensinogen. Now, in the name, angio, blood vessel, tensin, pressure, O-G-E-N, it's not doing anything. That's what O-G-E-N means. It's just stored and inactive. So it's a blood pressure chemical that's not doing anything. It needs to be activated. Renin activates it. Chops it up, chops off the OGEN, and now it's called angiotensin. Angiotensin 1 doesn't really do much. But as it's floating through the bloodstream, it comes across, it goes through the vascular supply for all these different tissues. Now, when it gets to the lungs tend to produce a whole bunch of this enzyme called angiotensin-converting enzyme, also known as ACE. And it does what it says it does, converts angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2. And now we've got angiotensin 2 that does all the important functions that we're after here. Remember, the stimulus was a drop in blood pressure or a drop in blood volume. Angiotensin 2, its job is to counteract it. So it does a couple of things. First thing is that it's a generalized vasoconstrictor. Constricts veins, constricts arteries. All of this increases resistance, increasing blood pressure. Tick, maintaining homeostasis. It also goes to the adrenal gland and triggers the release of aldosterone, which goes back to the kidneys, increases the absorption of sodium, reabsorption, I should say, of sodium back into the blood. Wherever sodium goes, water follows, increasing blood volume, increasing blood pressure. Tick, homeostasis. It also goes to the hypothalamus to trigger the release of antidiuretic hormone, ADH, also known as vasopressin by the Americans.
Yankees.
Oh, I don't know if we can say that. And what that does is goes to the kidneys as well, and increases the reabsorption of water directly. So it works similar to aldosterone, except just bypasses the sodium reabsorption. And then what else does it do?
I think you've done it all.
Pretty much it? Okay, cool.
I mean, it changes, angiotensin 2 also changes the vasculature in the kidneys.
Yes, that's very true. Increasing the pressure at the kidneys. All right, so that's the system. Renin, angiotensin, aldosterone, right? Now, two of these next ones that we're going to talk about. That's
basically
with
three.
Okay. All three.
To some degree come off this RAS system.
Perfect.
Yep.
So let's do the first one that you've got there.
So the first one goes to the ACE enzyme.
Okay.
And inhibits it.
So angiotensin converting enzyme, I said predominantly produced by the lungs, converts angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, just stops it.
Yep.
So that means we don't get angiotensin 2 made.
Yep.
So all of those downstream effects to boost blood pressure don't happen.
Pretty
no
much.
No generalized vasoconstriction, pretty no much. Aldosterone release, no ADH release.
Yep.
Okay.
So these group of drugs end with the suffix pril.
They're the prils.
So prils.
All right.
So the first one that was discovered, created, I guess, was captopril.
Yep.
But not that commonly used anymore because it's got a very short half-life. You need to take it multiple times a day.
Oh.
So it's not as common as an olanoprim, which is the one that's probably more commonly used.
Isn't there a verapamil as well?
Yep. There's probably a whole group of them, but the later ones probably have a longer action and therefore not needing such amount of dosages.
Now, it might be reasonable for somebody to say, wouldn't these only work if it is a RAS-induced hypertension? And most people have an essential or primary hypertension, which means we don't know what the cause is. So it might be something happening at the kidneys. We don't know what or why. And again, this drug may be utilized, and if the blood pressure drops, whoopee.
Yeah. Right? So yeah, like you said, some primary hypertension might be more as a result of excessive renin release, and so these drugs might be more beneficial there than some that may not be induced by a renin hyperactivity, so therefore other drugs that we're going to talk about may be more effective.
Do you know why we don't have – so we've got an ACE inhibitor, right? And the other two we're going to talk about inhibits other parts of this pathway. But there's no renin inhibitor.
No, there is.
There is?
There is.
Okay. How come it's not utilized?
I don't think it's overly effective.
Gotcha.
It's called alisacrin.
Alisacrin.
Yeah.
Okay. So it does inhibit. Okay. Because I always thought that, because it's just like, well, we've got all these other downstream inhibitors. Why don't we just inhibit the source?
Yeah.
But I suppose we either can't make a drug that does it well enough, I suppose.
Yeah. I didn't explore it too deeply, but there is one that does it, but it's not commonly used.
So anything else about ACE you'd like to talk about?
It seems to be more effective at the vessels. So this would be capacitate and resistant blood vessels. So these would be vessels at kidney, brain and heart. So they seem to have a more powerful dilation effect there.
And is that because of the angiotensin II inhibition?
Could be, but also there's some other things that result from this medication, one being bradykinin.
Right.
So did you come across that at all when you did one of your recent videos on blood pressure?
No.
No, you didn't come across bradykinin.
Apart from the fact that bradykinin's released to vasodilate.
Yeah. So it could have an effect there.
I mean, there would be a whole bunch of the ACE receptors, yeah. Right? So obviously ACE receptors are going to be present all over the place, and one of which is going to stimulate the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. But there's going to be a whole bunch of other effects of ACE.
Yeah, I think, right? But I think one of the effects being bradykinin being released from this particular classification of drugs. Mm. And so by having more bradykinin present within blood vessels, presumably this is maybe where you have a greater effect in the blood vessels of kidney, brain and heart, but you also have more bradykinin present because you mentioned that ACE is probably more abundant, let's say, in the vasculature of the lungs. And so this bradykinin in the lungs is one of its common side effects, being a cough.
So is it to counteract ACE? Because bradykinin dilates and ACE is going to
– I think it's just strict. I think it just comes about by the – I don't know, the presence of this drug just for some reason increases the amount of bradykinin.
Interesting.
In
because I know that – so this is ACE-1 that we're referring to, right? There's other ACE – versions, isoforms, whatever, like ACE2. And ACE2 is actually the receptor for COVID-19.
Mm.
And what ACE2 does is it does the opposite of ACE1. So while ACE1 in this conversation increases blood pressure through this RAS pathway, ACE2 reduces blood pressure. That's its job. And so there's been questions about COVID-19 binding to ACE2 and having various effects, and whether that affects the blood pressure as well, and whether people on antihypertensive drugs need to be careful about COVID-19 or not. So far, it doesn't seem to be a relationship there, but that was an initial thought.
Okay.
All right, so that's ACE.
So just with the side effects, the most common ones, cough is a significant side effect associated with this drug.
Because of the bradykinins.
Yeah.
So both histamines, bradykinins.
Yeah. And it's thought that this is probably one of the main reasons for why it's discontinued, because of the chronic cough. And I actually think if patients present to a general practitioner with a chronic cough, one of the first questions would be if you are on an ACE inhibitor.
Yes.
Some people can go into more serious bradykinin-induced effects, and so they can get angioedema.
Yep.
So that's kind of probably an early kind of hypersensitivity condition.
Yep.
Like you said, hypotension is a particularly on the early first dose uses of this drug. You can get quite a big drop in blood pressure.
Yep.
And the effect of the kidney can cause proteinuria.
Right. So the ACE inhibitors can increase bradykinin release. Yeah. The ACE inhibitors specifically.
Yeah.
Not ACE itself, but ACE inhibitors.
Yeah, that's right.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right, interesting.
So now we're still staying on the A's.
All right.
We're going slightly downstream a bit.
Yeah.
So now we go to the angiotensin 2 receptor blockers.
All right, same pathway, different part of it. So
what do you call these? ARBs.
ARBs. Okay. Angiotensin 2 receptor blockers.
Okay.
So angiotensin 2 is made now, but we're blocking its ability to bind to its receptors. My assumption would be these receptors are on the vasculature, parts of the nervous system, and parts of the kidneys, which makes sense because it's going to, like adrenal glands, because it releases aldosterone. It goes to the brain, release antidiuretic hormone, a vasopressin, and it goes to the blood vessels to constrict. So these are my assumption is that's where these ARBs work predominantly.
Yep, yep.
And all of which obviously going to reduce blood pressure.
Yep.
Okay.
And these end with the suffix sartan.
Sartans.
Yeah.
Ooh, okay.
So cool. These might be used after an ACE inhibitor if you were to get these side effects. So you wouldn't get the chronic cough with these sartans.
Because it's downstream.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
What I came across, one of the common uses for these would be for younger people that seem to have hypertension that may be associated with high renin release, and also people who have hypertension with diabetes. These drugs seem to be, you know, useful in those particular categories.
Interesting.
Two main considerations with the use of these, one being, again, you get that kind of hypotension reaction, but also it is tetragenic. So it would be not advised to take it during pregnancy.
It can induce teratoma.
Well, not teratoma. It's just inducing the likelihood of having birth defects and issues with the embryo developing.
Okay, there you go.
Yep.
All right, so that's the ARBs, that is those that end in sartan.
Yep.
Is there another A? This is our fourth A?
Well, you could probably put this one,
Matt's screwing the whole thing. What is it?
You could technically put this into the diuretics.
Right.
But it's around aldosterone.
Okay.
So it's basically an aldosterone blocker.
Okay.
Okay.
So now we're even further downstream on the RAS system and aldosterone's been released, goes to the distal convoluted tubule, increases the reabsorption of sodium back into the blood, water follows, blood volume goes up, blood pressure goes up. So if we stop that, we stop blood pressure from going up.
Yep. So this one is sometimes referred to as the potassium sparing diuretics.
What's its name?
For this? Oh, spironolactone. Yep. The spironolactone is a common example of this type of drug mechanism. So it's an aldosterone blocker. So it, like you said, it has an effect at the bottom end of the nephron.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's referred to as a potassium sparing diuretic because the other diuretics that we'll get to actually expel potassium into the urine. This one doesn't.
And so is this because generally sodium is exchanged for potassium in this area?
Yeah, that's right.
So when we reabsorb sodium into the body, potassium gets excreted. But if we're blocking that, sodium gets excreted and potassium gets reabsorbed.
And that would be its diuretic component.
Yeah. Because we pee out sodium and the water follows.
But it's not a huge diuretic. It's not like a loop diuretics we're going to get to.
Yep.
But it could be just enough for that effect. Yep.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's not a huge, strong, powerful diuretic, but it can have a benefit in that sense.
Cool.
Some of the effects of this, it would be because aldosterone also seems to run similar with the androgens. So you can get certain effects like that you would see with the androgens on the body.
So androgens are male sex hormones and that's not a surprise because both are released by the adrenal gland.
Yep. Okay. So impacting the way that the receptors works for the androgen, particularly progesterone as well.
Right.
So impotence could be one, or gynecomastia. There we go.
So that's due to
the similarities. Blocking,
that's due to this antihypertensive.
Yes, yes. The similarities with the way that receptors work for androgens.
So B, We're up to B. We've done the A's. There's four A's. We're up to B. What's the B?
These will be
come
the,
on, B. What's B?
This is going to be the beta blockers.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So we spoke about alpha 1 antagonists straight up, which are adrenergic receptors.
Yep.
Beta blockers are the beta version. So beta 1, beta 2. So it blocks those.
Essentially should be beta 1 receptor blockers.
So beta 1 specific.
Well, they should be, but there are going to be non-specific beta blockers.
Okay, so let's just go back. The beta receptors, I said early on in this podcast that if it's alpha 1, beta 1, that you throw adrenaline at it, it stimulates the tissue to do its job. If it's alpha 2, beta 2, throw noradrenaline at it, it inhibits the tissue from doing its job. And we just said now that non-specific or non-selective beta blockers, if you throw noradrenaline, well, if you throw the beta blocker at them, it's going to inhibit them.
Yeah.
So it's going to inhibit beta 1 and it's going to result in an activation of beta 2 in a way. So because I'm using double negatives.
Yes,
here. So let me just give you an example. Beta 1 is located on the heart. You throw noradrenaline at it, the heart rate increases. Makes sense
because
it's stimulating the tissue. Beta 2 is located on the muscles of the airways. Throw noradrenaline at it, it inhibits them from contracting, so they dilate.
Yeah.
Now, if you throw a beta blocker at both of these, throw a beta blocker at beta 1, the heart's going to relax because it's blocking that stimulatory effect. Mm. If you throw a beta blocker at beta 2, well, it's blocking the inhibitory effect, which results in an activation.
Yeah.
So the muscles in the airways constrict. So one of the downsides of the beta, the non-selective beta blockers.
So these are the OLs?
The LOLs? I say LOLs. Is it OLs?
OLs or LOLs.
Okay. So it's the funny one. So the beta blockers are the funny ones. They're the LOLs or OLs.
So a non-selective would be propranolol.
Propranolol.
Yep. So technically, because you are blocking the beta 2, which is the bronchodilation, you could induce bronchoconstriction.
Which may not be good for somebody with a respiratory disorder.
Yeah, so people who arguably have respiratory challenges like asthma, or let's just say unstable asthma and COPD, these drugs, non-selectives, would be cautioned against.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Okay. But you might have but there's also selective beta blockers.
So this would be like an atenolol.
Beta 1 selective.
Yeah.
Makes no sense if it's beta 2 selective, right? All right, so it's a beta 1 selective.
I don't think there is beta 2 specific blockers.
No, you're right. What would be the purpose of that? Why would we want to constrict the airways? What are those ones called? What are the beta 1 selective ones called?
An example?
Yeah.
Atenolol.
Atenolol. And what was a non-selective?
Propranolol.
Gotcha. All right, cool. And so they just work through the adrenergic receptors.
But interestingly, I came across this with some of the research is you would have thought that, say, the non-selectives would be advised against in, say, an unstable asthma.
Which you literally just said. Yeah.
But they're exploring it in stable asthma as being a benefit.
Why? How?
That's as far as I got. but if you're
bearing the lead.
So if you have an asthmatic state, but it's well controlled, then the use of a non-selective seems to be not such a bad thing, opposed to an individual that would have very poorly managed up and down episodes. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So what else do you have about the beta blockers?
Well, then you can get further non-selective beta blockers, which then have other different effects. So you can get some
like off-target effects.
Yeah, you can get some beta blockers that also block the alpha ones.
Oh, gotcha.
And so that not only has a heart effect, but then it has the blood vessel effects, what you saw in the alpha ones.
Yep.
But then there's also beta 1 blockers that seem to increase nitric oxide release.
Oh, okay.
And so then they have that
vasodilatory effect.
Yep.
Very cool.
But these would have, look, from my research, they're not as heavily relied on as they once were for hypertension.
No. Can I tell you why?
The only thing I'll add to that is it seems that these drugs are more effective in hypertension that's like stress-induced or excitable hypertension. Yeah. So I don't know.
Anxiety.
So it's more effective there than a person that may not have that.
Yeah. Well, beta blockers are also anxiolytic, right?
Yeah.
So they're used as one of its off-label effects is that of an anti-anxiety medication. One of the reasons why it's not a first-line antihypertensive is a large study was performed and it seemed that the beta blockers were simply just less effective at being protective of cardiovascular events like associated with hypertension in people over 60. So basically they looked at all these people of varying ages who are on antihypertensive drugs and then had a look at their likelihood of mortality over a particular time frame, and then they're having a particular cardiovascular event, and they're like, oh, they're all protective, but the beta blockers were less protective in the population over 60.
Okay.
So that's why it's not that it doesn't work, it's just that it wasn't as protective as the others.
Right. Okay.
So that's the beta blockers. So yeah,
some of the side effects, just quickly to run through, we've already spoke about the airway issues. So that's one consideration.
Supposed issues.
Well, again, patient with COPD, unstable asthma, you'd be advised against using beta blockers for. Yeah. Okay.
Well, at least non-selective.
Yep. Bradycardia, because that's the effect on the heart. Hypoglycemia. General fatigue.
Should we also say that these beta 1 receptors are located
in other regions of the body.
On the SA node and the AV node, so heart rate or conductance, but also on the myocardium.
Yeah, so what are those two things referred to? The chronotrophic and the inotrophic effect?
That's right, yeah. So timing and force.
Which we'll come into when we get to the Cs as well. And the final, I'm sure there's many more side effects, but the other one I've got down here would be cold extremities, which presumably comes from the way that the blood flow is to the fingers and the toes and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. Done with the Bs?
That's right.
Okay.
Let's do C.
Cs, there's technically two, but we'll start with one.
Okay. What is it?
Well, C for calcium, mate.
C for calcium. When I think calcium, I always think contraction.
Bones. Oh, okay.
No. I think contraction.
Milk.
Maybe, but I think contraction. All right? Okay. Don't try and change my mind. C for contraction, C for calcium. When calcium enters a cell, that cell contracts if it's a contractile cell, right?
Yeah.
And so the importance here is that obviously if calcium enters a myocardial cell, so heart muscle cell, that heart muscle is going to contract harder.
Yeah.
And so if you block calcium, you block the strength of the contractile force. And we know in our blood pressure equation, if you reduce the contractile force, you reduce the blood pressure. So this is just very broadly one of the mechanisms of the calcium antagonist. Is it calcium blocker or calcium antagonist?
Calcium channel
blockers.
Or antagonists.
But they also have an effect at the blood vessels as well.
Yeah, there's two categories.
So there's the dihydropyridines. Pyridines and the non-dihydropyridines.
Yep.
Now from memory, correct me if I'm wrong, the dihydropyridines work at the heart and the non-dihydropyridines work at the vasculature by blocking calcium.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I think that's how it is. I think the dihydropyridines stop calcium at the heart, reducing contractile force, reducing blood pressure, and the non-dihydropyridines stop calcium influx at the muscles of the blood vessels, stopping the vasoconstriction
Which results in the dilation, yeah.
And resulting in reduced resistance, reduced blood pressure.
Yeah, so the more specific ones, which are the blood vessels like nifedipine, or should I say the suffix is pine.
Pine.
And the reason for that
like
is-
Chris Pine, one of your favorite actors.
Really?
You don't know what he's in.
I think he's a politician. Christopher Pine.
Yeah, maybe he is. Well, isn't there an actor called Chris Pine? Isn't he the guy that's in Star Trek and Wonder Woman?
I don't know.
Well, you don't watch movies.
You stole my thunder. I was going to come up with some stupid thing like it's named after pine cones because they're full of calcium. And then you would have said, exactly, you would have said, are they? And I said, of course not. But now you've remembered them.
That's Chris Pine. Okay. I've just showed Matt a picture of Chris Pine. That is an actor. You've seen him before? Matt is lying. He's never watched a movie in his entire life. I watch all these Marvel movies and Matt's never seen it. Have you seen one Marvel movie?
Yeah, I think I saw it on a plane.
Which one?
One with Thor in it.
Maybe like 15 with Thor in it. Anyway, it's a bit of a digression. So pine, the suffix is pine.
And okay. So the specific ones like nifedipine, yep. Nifedipine.
Yeah.
I say peen. Do you say pine? Nifedipine?
I say pine. I say nifedipine. Nifedipine. Then I tell people that the suffix is pine.
Yeah, yeah. That's specific to vessels.
Okay.
And then you have-
So that's a non-dihydropyridine?
And then you have the verapamil, which is both heart vessels.
You're doing really well today.
I'm terrible with the medication. Yeah.
Generally, yes, but I think you're doing quite well today.
So that's more non-selective, that one.
Yeah.
And that's heart and vessels, right. But then you're more likely to get further side effects from that one, like constipation.
Oh, because you're stopping the peristalsis.
Yeah, the calcium in the smooth muscle.
There's all these off-target effects like calcium going into the muscle of the bowel, which helps move poop through.
Yeah.
If you stop that, you stop the poop moving through, constipation.
Which is not what you want.
Generally not.
Other side effect of the calcium channel blockers would be ankle swelling associated with edema.
Why? Why would there be edema?
Whether there's retention from the way other vascular changes, I'm not sure. That's me hypothesizing.
Making stuff up, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
From the top of your head, does it have an effect with the venous constriction?
I assume so. They've got smooth muscle. Not as much, but it would work via calcium.
So I'm just
I don't know if the receptors are the same.
I'm just trying to make sense of that ankle swelling. Mm. Presumably, if it's staying within the tissue.
Could it be the fact that you've got normal venous return, but the heart is contracting less efficiently and maybe you have more fluid accumulating in the venous supply and that results in an increase in hydrostatic pressure, pushing fluid out?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Again, we're hypothesizing on this part of the...
Not the whole podcast.
Not the whole podcast.
Okay, the other C, just to... Right. Are you happy... done with calcium channels?
Pretty good with that.
Okay. The other C that we could add, it's a bit of a stretch.
Oh, God.
Because you could probably argue it could go into the A's.
Oh, really?
But I'm going to pull it to the C.
Just what does it start with? That's all we care about.
It's the central actin adreno receptor antagonist.
What is that? Central acting adreno receptor antagonist.
So to be technical, it's an alpha 2 agonist.
Here we go. So that's an A. But alpha 2 is presynaptic, postsynaptic,
correct.
Sympathetic neurons.
Presynaptic, yeah.
And it inhibits it from sending another sympathetic.
Correct.
It's basically the self-regulatory mechanism for sympathetic.
And then
neurons.
And because it's centrally, these.
Your logic, did you make that up or did.
No, it's there. Well, central actin. Adrenergic receptor block.
I would look. How come you didn't do? Okay, fine.
We can do alpha if you want, but anyway, essentially, what it is an alpha 2 agonist, and like you said, the alpha 2 receptor is located on the presynaptic terminal, and so if you agonize that, you kind of downplay the sympathetic nervous system.
Yeah, because it's alpha two. It results in the inhibition of that tissue. And in this case, the tissue is a sympathetic neuron. So it stops it from releasing any more noradrenaline. So stopping any downstream sympathetic effect.
So clonidine is a good example of this drug.
Oh, yeah.
Another one is methadopa.
So is clonidine used as an antihypertensive?
It can do. It's not generally
used for that.
Also migraine.
Yeah.
Did you use it when you had bad migraines?
Yes.
Clonidine?
Yes.
Did it help?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's that's because of its – I thought it was because of its vascular effects. But I could be wrong. I should probably have looked into that. Not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the downstream effect is.
Does the clonidine have dopaminergic action?
Well, the other one is methyl-DOPA, which is a pro-drug that gets converted into methyl noradrenaline. But again, I didn't get a great deal more than that. They're not heavily used as antihypertensive medications, but yeah. The clonidine seems to be associated with migraines in terms of its use.
Okay.
The side effects seem to some degree outweigh potentially its use. So
yeah.
Heavy drowsiness, orthostatic hypotension and weight gain.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, again, a first line. But you could either put that into the A's. Remember, it's an alpha 2 agonist. You can put it into the A's, or I just called it a central actin because it acts on the first neuron
yeah.
in the sympathetic.
I just checked, I didn't use clonidine
okay.
on my migraines. It was something else. All right, so D, are we up to D? Diuretics. Okay, diuretics.
Two main ones here.
Really?
Because we already did the aldosterone blocker, the spironolactones.
Yeah. So I thought, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought that the major diuretic that's utilized as an antihypertensive are the thiazide and thiazide-like diuretics. Are there others?
Yeah, loop diuretics can be also used, but again, they're not... they're so powerful, they're probably going to have drawbacks because there's such a powerful in diuresis, you're going to have side effects. So maybe if it's hypertension with other things like maybe edema or heart failure, then maybe this medication could be used.
Right.
And I think this is what goes back to what you said earlier, that the choice in these drugs could be a combination of which is effective to reduce blood pressure, but also with the specific to the patient. So if the patient had other comorbidities, it may be worth considering using a particular drug for that kind of do two at once. So
just remember that a diuretic increases urine output.
Mm-hmm.
That's its job. And therefore decreases the volume of fluid in the body, i.e. the blood, and decreasing blood volume decreases blood pressure. And generally, the diuretics work by increasing not just the output of water directly, but it increases the urinary excretion of ions. So charged atoms or elements like sodium and potassium and magnesium and chloride and so forth, predominantly sodium. So if it increases their excretion, water just follows. Water just gets pulled with it through osmosis. Right? And then that increases the urinary output, decreasing blood volume. So in this case, one of the most effective for hypertension is the thiazide and thiazide-like diuretics, which tend to work at the distal convoluted tubule from memory. And should I talk about how it works?
Yes, please do.
Okay, so you should always remember that every cell of the body has a sodium potassium ATPase pump. Its job is to throw three sodium. Now remember, sodium has a positive charge. Throws three sodium out of the cell back into the blood, in this case, and two potassium into the cell. So we're talking about the cells of the tubules of the nephrons, right? And there's a couple of different options for where these ions go. So if they're in the tubule, they're destined to be excreted out of the body. So if it's in the tubule, think about it as outside the body. If it's in the bloodstream, think about it as inside the body, right? And then the cell is basically in between those two environments. So you've filtered your blood, you've got all of these ions moving through the tubules destined to be peed out. Mm-hmm. But as it comes across the distal tubule cell, so one of the cells right at the very end, it notices that this cell has no sodium in it. And the reason why is because the sodium potassium pump has thrown the sodium out into the bloodstream, but thrown potassium from the bloodstream into the cell. But the cell's void of sodium. So sodium goes from the tubule, destined to be peed out, back into the cell. And then from the cell, the sodium potassium pump throws it back into the body. Brilliant. We've just reabsorbed our sodium, right? Now, the thing is that the way the sodium gets from the tubule into the cell isn't by itself. chloride piggybacks with it. So it's a sodium chloride co-transporter. So now I've got chloride into the cell and chloride will move through a chloride channel to go back into the body. Brilliant. We've now got sodium chloride back in the body. Now at the same time, there's a calcium channel. And calcium will move from the tubule into the cell, and then calcium will move from the cell back into the body or back into the blood by exchanging with sodium that's in the blood. And that's fine because we've just absorbed a whole bunch of sodium back in the blood. So calcium goes back into the blood or body, but sodium goes back into the cell. But that's okay because the sodium potassium pump throws it back out again. So we've just reabsorbed sodium, we've just reabsorbed chloride, we've just reabsorbed calcium, all right? Now here's the thing, the thiazide and thiazide-like diuretics, they work by blocking the sodium chloride co-transporter. Now what that means is that cell has no sodium in it. Mm-hmm. So the sodium potassium pump, it works, but it throws out all the sodium that's available inside the cell and no sodium is moving into the cell because that channel's blocked. But the sodium potassium pump always needs to work. And it's going, hey, there's no sodium inside the cell. That means I can't throw potassium back out. What can I do? But there's the calcium sodium exchanger. And it is throwing calcium out and throwing sodium back in to replenish it just so that pump can work. But in order for that pump to work, that calcium sodium exchanger needs to work overtime to keep replenishing that sodium back into the cell. And in doing so, it throws way, way, way too much calcium back into the body. And the side effect here by blocking this channel is one, the sodium stays in the tubule and we pee it out. Water follows. That's the diuretic effect, reducing blood volume, reducing blood pressure. But a side effect is we reabsorb more calcium. And that means this particular antihypertensive drug might be useful for people who not just have hypertension, but also have osteoporosis, increasing the available calcium for their bones and blood.
Okay.
Hopefully that made sense to people and they didn't switch off.
The other thing I'll just add to these thiazide-like diuretics, obviously in the short term, they're going to have the diuretic effect of lowering blood pressure, which is decreased blood volume, decreased stroke volume, therefore decreased cardiac output, therefore decreased blood pressure. Yep. But this seems to drop off fairly rapidly and there is a-
As in the body sort of hits this, it responds to this and goes, yeah, I'm not going to maintain this.
So there seems to be a secondary effect with thiazide diuretics and that's a vasodilating effect. So it has an effect on the peripheral vascular resistance.
Cool.
So that's an additional. So that's, and like you said, some side effects being with the calcium, but you are going to be losing potassium with this particular type of diuretic.
Yes. And that's because that sodium potassium pump, as it's throwing sodium back into the body, it's pulling the potassium back into the cell, which then moves through diffusion back into the tubule and you pee it out.
Yep. And then you go to the other type of diuretics, which is the loop diuretics, and they're in the ascending part of the loop. So we go down to the bottom of the loop of the nephron and then start to go back up. So there's some channels there which have they reabsorb 2 chloride, 1 sodium, 1 potassium.
Yep.
And so because it's sucking in a lot of ions, it's also going to pull water with it. But because you're blocking it with this diuretic, and the example here is a furosemide, you're going to leave a lot of molecules, a lot of ions in the tubule. Therefore, a lot of water will stay with it. And that's why it's a powerful diuretic.
Yep.
So in this case, and this is probably why it's not used in isolation for hypertension without other things is because you get the likelihood, particularly with elderly people with hypovolemia and therefore hypotension and then a hypokalemia because you're getting rid of potassium.
Yeah.
So that's really the diuretics. So do you have any to add?
Not for diuretics. And then E, the one that you've added on the end here.
So this is really stretching the friendship, I think. this is working around endothelium.
In our ABCDE or our friendship?
Both.
All right.
Not endothelium. What is it?
Need a friendship to begin with. Endothelin.
Endothelin.
Which is released by endothelium.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So this does what?
Constricts blood vessels.
Okay.
So there's actually when you think about vasodilation, vasoconstriction, obviously.
And isn't this the most powerful one?
Yeah, that's it. So the most powerful or potent vasodilator is nitric oxide.
Okay.
And the most potent vasoconstrictor.
And you give that, you could give that when someone's having like an angina effect, outcome. Yep. You give them a drug that induces nitric oxide.
Yeah.
And that dilates particularly the coronary arteries.
More blood gets in, more feeding. But yeah, nitric oxide, most potent vasodilator. Endothelin, on the other hand, most potent vasoconstrictor.
More than angiotensin 2.
Well, I would not be surprised, and somebody can correct me.
No, if they're having a battle.
Well, like I think angiotensin 2 works by releasing endothelin.
An MMA battle. Is that the right term?
I don't know if I've ever watched the UFC. And
UFC. Like,
and now we've got an MMA battle between.
Endothelin.
No, see, this is the thing. Endothelin is the boxing glove.
Okay. Right? You really ruined this for me.
I'm sorry, but you can't just make up UFC analogies willy-nilly. many of the vasoconstricting effects of, let's say, the sympathetic nervous system and other certain drugs often, not always obviously, but often work simply by triggering the release of endothelin.
Okay.
Right. So, and it's not as though it's angiotensin 2 does it one way and endothelin does another. I wouldn't be surprised, and I don't know this exactly, so someone can correct me, but I wouldn't be surprised if angiotensin 2 is a vasoconstrictor through the release of endothelin.
Okay.
Yeah.
So basically this E in this category of drugs is endothelin blockers.
Right, that makes sense.
I don't know how heavily it's used, but it seems to be beneficial in pulmonary hypertension. So this is where you would have an increase in blood pressure, but within the pulmonary circuit,
right,
which would be particularly problematic to put a lot of pressure and strain on the right side of the heart. Yep. So any condition that could induce a pulmonary hypertension, maybe this classification of drugs is something that's entertained as a use, but it's not a big one. It's not definitely not a primary go-to
or
medication
line,
but I just thought it adds another letter to our ABCD.
It definitely does. So if we take all of these, right, so the alpha-1 antagonists, the ACE inhibitors, the angiotensin receptor blockers, the
aldosterone blockers,
the beta blockers, the calcium channel antagonists, the diuretics and endothelin.
Don't forget the central actin adrenergic agonists.
of all of those, generally speaking, first-line antihypertensives, and again, it's dependent.
Well, as we had a USC with these.
All right. You need to stop thinking UFC. You've got some sort of
what was it with the WWF?
Or E. It's WWE now, isn't it?
Where they
obviously haven't.
It was just
it
like an in-for-all with them all and just like, having a battle.
What is that called? It's like the Big Bash or something. Yeah.
Remember that, like you had the Undertaker come in and then the Ultimate Warrior and they just went Hulk Hogan.
Like a rumble, big rumble.
Royal Rumble or something, right?
Something like that.
So
yeah,
this is the Royal Rumble.
Right.
Of blood pressure.
I'm glad we're able to sneak a WWF from the 80s reference in. What I was trying to say was that the first line antihypertensives generally of these, but again, it's patient specific, are the ACE inhibitors, the angiotensin 2 receptor blockers, the calcium channel antagonists, and the thiazide-like diuretics. They're generally the first line. But again, depending on the individual, some of these may be contraindicated because of some underlying
kidney
condition.
Issues.
Or maybe there's some other issue they have which makes them worth using one over another.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the outcome is trying to drop the blood pressure values. And that's the most important thing.
Well said. Well said.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Now, the last point I'd like to put in.
There's nothing after E, Michael.
There is, and it's N for sodium. Because one way that blood pressure can be managed is through the diet and by restricting or reducing. So I don't think we can do
salt tablets.
No, the opposite. Okay. Don't have salt tablets. Reducing salt intake.
Because my goats have a salt lick.
Do they?
Should I take their blood pressure?
I would like to know if you've licked it.
No.
Is it literally just a big block of salt?
I think so.
And is it because they don't get enough sodium in their diet?
It's pink.
Himalayan. Oh, you've gone fancy with your goat.
That's all I can get.
Is it because they don't get sodium from the grass?
Good question. I really should know this.
You should.
But they really do like it.
Yeah.
But it's common, I think, in livestock. They have salt licks.
I think all animals, yeah, including us, love salt. I mean, the word celery comes from the Latin word sale, or even Italian sale for salt.
My goats don't own a dime, so I got
to talk. Well, they do because you just paid them in salt, man.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway, my point is that salt reduction.
So they're going to have hypertension. That's what you're saying.
And if you want to learn more about the salt effect in hypertension, we spoke about it in the hypertension episode about people who may be salt sensitive and salt sensitive hypertensive individuals and so forth. So anyway, look, I think we're done. It's been 1 hour. We've done a great job.
I think we're done with blood pressure for a while.
I think so. We've done 3 episodes on it.
Yeah, it seems like that's consumed us for some time.
Yeah, I think my blood pressure's gone up just from focusing on it for so long. So please remember that we are providing you these podcasts for free. They're even ad-free. I don't think you've had one ad because we don't have ads, maybe in the future. You want to sponsor us? Anyway, so we provide this content for free because we like doing this. And all we expect in response is for you to give us a 5-star rating, thank us, say we're the best in the world. You tell your friends, you create a fan club where you create all these idols that you pray. No, sorry, I got carried away. We just want you to just give us a 5-star rating and say thanks and tell your friends that we've helped you within your studies. That's it. That's all we expect. We've also got a YouTube channel. Again, these videos are free. Dr. Matt and Dr. Mike, we're very original when it comes to naming things. And you can access us on social media, predominantly me at Dr. Mike Todorovic at DrMiketodorovic. Matt is only on Twitter and he barely uses that, which is at Dr. Bartox, DrBartox.
It's because I get heckled a lot.
Yeah, you do. You do. Understandably.
Yeah.
People don't like you. I get it. I get it. If you also want to vote Matt off the team, please send your vote to, you can send us an email at GU Biosciences.
To vote me off.
Yeah, vote him off the island, off the Dr. Matt, Dr. Mike Corporation, and I will find
a replacement.
A replacement.
Wouldn't be hard. It really wouldn't be hard.
Well, it won't be hard to find somebody better.
Yeah.
Yeah. But maybe somebody of your caliber, Matthew. Even easier. All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Maddie.
Thank you, listeners. Enjoy yourself and keep that blood pressure low.
Sounds good.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.